Hello, hello, and welcome to the Majlis, the podcast by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, focusing on Central Asia. I'm Mohammed Tahir, your host here in Washington, D.C. We are back to Obor, China's One Belt, One Road project for the second time this year. The reason is the recent comprehensive report by the Hack Center for Strategic Studies on Obor. There are some striking points in the report, especially the part which deals with the possible involvement of security dimensions and long-term implications of the project on Central Asia. Though the focus of the report is not limited only with Central Asia, but for our purpose, let's try to remain in the region. To discuss the subject, I'm joined by Sibrondi Young, who is one of the authors of the report, also a strategic analyst at the Hague Center for the Strategic Studies. Sibron is joining us today. Guess from where? China. Jonathan Hillman is with us from Washington, D.C., who's the Senior Fellow and Director of the Reconnecting Asia Project at the Center for Strategic International Studies. And as always, Bruce Panier is joining us from Prague, who is the editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Central Asia blog. Welcome on board, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Very nice to have you. Sibron, let's start with you. We hear that that most of the infrastructure are ready for Obor. So how close are we from the actual and official launch?
Well, it kind of depends. I mean, it depends first and foremost which region you actually look at. I mean, if you look at, for example, a country such as Kazakhstan, yes, there has been quite some progress and quite a number of infrastructural projects have been built. However, when you move beyond Central Asia, when you actually go and delve into the greater Middle East and the connections in Central and Eastern Europe, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done, actually. So when you want to speak about a full completion of the Silk Road and the actually revitalization thereof, meaning that anything can be shipped from China to Western Europe via this entire route, then I'd say we're still some time away from that. But the progress has been significant. But as we describe in the report, there are numerous drawbacks to the way these things are financed.
John, maybe you would like to jump in here. So is there any hurdle yet to be dealt with, or you think path is smooth and clear leading up to the launch?
I think there are many hurdles. I think I often try to remember the infrastructure problems we face in the U.S. and how it's difficult even for people in the best business environments to get big projects done on time and on budget. And so you take just the inherent challenge of managing large projects and you put them into environments with security challenges, with governance issues, and you know the difficulty just goes up and up from there. So I think there's a whole host of challenges that we could talk about, ranging from the commercial to the economic viability to some of the strategic challenges too, as other countries are thinking about how to respond.
Sibron, is it a consideration among the Chinese officials? I mean, the hurdles that John was talking about.
Well, I mean, first and foremost, they have different considerations at play here. So when you think about the creation of the Silk Road, the foremost reason is it's an extension of a domestic policy, essentially. So when you look at the overcapacity that Chinese companies have, major industrial corporations, then obviously they need different markets to ship their products to and sell their services to. The one thing you do not want, of course, is to have a looming problem of unemployment in China. So there's probably less consideration for the factors just mentioned, simply because, well, it's finding markets for companies, and sometimes the investments made are actually not necessarily reflective of what the host country needs. So sometimes you inadvertently create situations whereby you invest money and you in the infrastructural project, you lend money to the host country, perhaps even on favorable conditions, possibly. But because the project might not be profitable in the end, you run the risk of them not being able to actually pay back these loans. And then obviously, if there's some delay, if there are problems along the line, you're going to be sucked into domestic political circumstances in nations. To give you an example, if you're speaking about Pakistan, I mean, that obviously is a country they had to bail out already once. So pouring in $50 billion worth of investments in the context of this China-Pakistan economic corridor, it's rather questionable whether this is actually going to be delivering any sort of tangible profits. I mean, I'm quite skeptical about all of this.
Interesting. You obviously mentioned Pakistan. I think, Bruce, you would like to jump in here. So how important is this for Central Asia, this project?
Well, I mean, it's hugely important for Central Asia. I don't think there's been any question of that, you know, really from the start, because, you know, OBOR as an initiative wasn't articulated until 2013, I believe. But actually, you know, the blueprint for OBOR in a lot of ways came in Central Asia because of Chinese investment in the last decade when they were building up infrastructure projects, roads, railways, pipelines, things like that, to bring goods back to China. So it was kind of like a testing ground for the whole OBOR concept. And, you know, it was just good timing all the way around. You know, Russia's economic situation has kind of gone up and down over the last 15 years. When Russia had a strong economy, of course, it was a big influence on the way things were being run in Central Asia. They invested in a lot of projects. But, you know, recently, for instance, in the last 3 years, that hasn't been the case. So it was incredibly fortuitous that China was, you know, at this time interested in investing large sums of money into projects that really the Central Asians could not have afforded to pay for on their own. There was no question about it. You know, these pipelines and railways and things like that are just beyond, even a country like Kazakhstan would have had a hard time paying for this. You know, but Sebrin brought up a good point with that, is that the downside of this is that all of them are running into debt to China, you know, and in some cases, it's possible they might be able to get themselves out of this. But in other cases, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, or even Turkmenistan, one wonders if they will ever be able to pay off this debt, or if they're looking long term down the road at some kind of deal like they get from Russia, where some of their debt is just written off because it's hopeless they could ever pay it back.
Hmm. John, do you share these concerns about the future of this project?
I certainly do. I think this is a classic political problem in a way, where you have leaders who love going to ribbon-cutting ceremonies and would love to announce new projects. And when they have the funds available, it's very difficult to say no, especially if you don't have alternatives. And in many cases, those people will not be the people who are around, you know, when it comes time to collect on that loan. And if countries aren't able to pay back economically, it raises the question of, you know, in what other way might they compensate?
Hmm. So what are the other ways to compensate?
So I think in some cases you could have a lender, in this case China, but, you know, I think we also need to remember China's not the only one backing projects. They could take equity in a project. And so, you know, I think there are concerns. Pakistan was mentioned. I think there are concerns about whether some of these industrial zones in Pakistan will be effectively run and sort of owned and operated by the Chinese. You could also have some diplomatic concessions. So you've seen in the UN, for example, voting related to the South China Sea disputes, you've seen China use economic levers to gain support for its position. And I think you could see, you know, it doing something similar with infrastructure projects in other countries and on other issues.
You know, just to continue this, Bruce, maybe you would like to talk on this. Now, when the money is pouring in, these are the good days. But so if things will not go the way it's planned, so what kind of danger you think Central Asians are getting into with this?
Well, the first thing is we've already seen some examples of what can happen when the countries are unable to pay back some of the loans. I'll use Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan as examples. In Tajikistan's case, I think they were actually trying to it was Chinese loans that were funding a thermal power plant in Dushanbe. There was a couple other projects too, but it was clear that they weren't going to have the money to pay that back. So they signed over rights to mining concessions. And Kyrgyzstan is might have done the same thing, although it's a pretty opaque deal. But there was talk about this railroad that China wants to run, China, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan. And of course, it's going to cost $5-6 billion, and half of it runs through Kyrgyzstan. They have no way of coming up with that kind of money on their own. So there has been reports that Kyrgyzstan also signed away mining rights to places. It's almost a barter system where the Chinese provide the money and then they have to pay back by handing over rights to raw materials within their own country. So this is one of the big problems. You know, of course, another thing, and I know that Sebrin's report got into this, is once you start to get really into debt with China, you know, and John just mentioned this too, then China has a lot of political influence in your decision making. A lot of things happen in international affairs, and maybe some of the moves that China is going to make in the future, foreign policy moves, are not going to be to the liking of the Central Asian governments. But when you owe somebody a lot of money. You know, I think in Beijing, they figure that if they do make unpopular moves, it's something that is not well received in Kazakhstan or any of the Central Asian countries, at least they have bought silence from these people against any criticism that they might have in the future. And of course, this is a problem too.
Yeah, yeah. We will get to this subject a little bit later, but before we get into the break, Sebrin, so from these perspective, reading the Chinese mind, so which are the countries in Central Asia which is more important for them than the others?
Well, I mean, you can basically tie this into some of the things Bruce already highlighted. So it's true that Central Asia has kind of been a testing ground for what Obor is trying to do now. So, and one country really, really jumps out, and that's Turkmenistan. Yeah. I mean, first and foremost, when you look at what the Chinese need from the region is raw materials. I mean, it's essentially they want to become less dependent on maritime routes through the Persian Gulf, for example, because they perceive this as an area dominated by U.S. Navy. So obviously they're looking for alternatives. Turkmenistan was one of the first ones to actually deliver natural gas on a massive scale. But as Bruce explained properly, the way they repay this is by means of deliveries in kind. So obviously, you know, they're not making a tremendous amount of money on this. The Chinese have financed all this infrastructure, which is great for them. But at the end of the day, you go from one level of dependency on Russia to another one on China. So which of these countries do matter most? I mean, in Central Asia, when you look at the whole constellation, it's mainly Kazakhstan for oil, it's Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan for gas. Mm. So these three, the pipeline that I mentioned from Turkmenistan that goes all the way to China is being expanded. So there's a couple of countries, links being added to this via Uzbekistan also. So that's likely to increase in prominence. But another problem is, when you, for example, tie all these developments, you know, the Obor-related developments, into what Russia has been trying to do with its Eurasian Economic Union, there you see that for the countries that are actually a member of the Eurasian Economic Union, all of this has been quite a mixed bag. Because Tajikistan, Kyrgyzstan have been trading with China on a big scale before, and now they're in another union, which means they have a uniform external rate, which actually was higher than they had before. So for them, this development hasn't been very good. So most of the countries in the region are increasingly looking at China, not to Russia, simply because that's not a real pull factor, and the pull factor is coming from Beijing.
Okay, so this was some of the short-term vision of Obor in Central Asia. We will continue the debate discussing pros and cons of this multi-trillion dollar project in long run shortly. Hey everyone, before we get into the second part of the show, just a quick reminder that if you really like Majlis podcast, there's a real chance that you will also like my other radio show that's called Gandhara Podcast. The show discusses latest developments in Pakistan and Afghanistan from local perspective. And the podcast is published in every second week on Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty's Gandhara website. It's a totally must-follow discussion for foreign policy nerds with interest in the region. First, let me recap the debate once more that today on the Majlis Radio Free Europe Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast, in the light of recent major report by the Hague Center for Strategic Studies, we are discussing China's Obor project and its Central Asia's importance for this and its importance for Central Asia and the hurdles on the way forward. Joining me in the discussion are from Chengdu, China, C. Ebron D. Young, who is one of the authors of the report and is also a strategic analyst at the Hague Center for Strategic Studies, from Washington, D.C., Jonathan Hellman, who is the Senior Fellow and Director of the Reconnecting Asia Project, and from Prague, Bruce Panier, the editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, Central Asia blog, is joining us. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis here in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, gentlemen. So, Sebrin, to continue with you, perhaps this is too late to ask, but I will ask anyway. As we are getting closer together with the realization of this project and the steps we have seen so far taken, what we have learned about China's real intentions behind this project?
We've really learned that the main intentions behind this project are, I mean, like I said before, it's partly has to do with the domestic policy in China. So they really want to avoid creating a risk of unemployment, not using industrial overcapacity that they have. So for that purpose, they're really actively searching markets to ship products to and sell services to. This in and of itself is not necessarily wrong. The only problem is that, of course, that there are issues with respect to the way all these projects are financed, whether or not they will be profitable, whether or not they'll match with what the host countries are looking for. Oftentimes, this isn't the case. But there's also, you know, a big geopolitical dimension to all of this, because, I mean, you only have to look at the various maritime choke points that exist around the world, where massive amounts of hydrocarbon exports are passing through on their way to China, where the Chinese want to become less dependent on these routes. So for them, the whole corridor through Central Asia serves that purpose of alleviating some of the pressure on areas such as the Strait of Hormuz, the Malacca Straits, et cetera, et cetera. So these are the primary reasons. But, you know, on top of this, and that's when you go beyond Central Asia and go more towards, you know, Central and Eastern Europe and Western Europe. There, you know, recently, of course, you know, the EU has tabled this proposal or is speaking about this proposal about how they want to vet investments from third countries, specifically China. Mm. You know, they're afraid. They're scared that strategic industries are going to be bought up, and that somehow, you know, expertise and intellectual property is going to find its way to Beijing in a way that they don't want it to. Hmm. So these are some of the concerns that we have woken up to.
Okay, so from your comments, I understand that the economic or political domination of the region, today we are talking about Central Asia, is not an immediate factor for Chinese officials behind this project. Is this understanding correct?
Well, I mean, it's a very important region, but it's a very important region mainly also because it holds valuable natural resources that are of key interest to the Chinese to keep their economy going. So this explains the interest in countries such as Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, and Turkmenistan. So, and of course, if you can build, for example, all kinds of infrastructural projects, but also energy-related projects in countries that are suffering from energy poverty, then perhaps you can also utilize some of your own expertise and actually get companies to work in countries where they can actually do some work rather than in China where you're facing overcapacity. So there's different reasons at play here, but the main sort of overarching geostrategic reason as to why they're interested in Central Asia really has to do with finding alternative routes for the shipment of natural resources.
If you look into this, Bruce, from Central Asian perspective, there are lots seems to be at play here. Like if this project is going to realize, it will bring China's huge political influence, as we discussed a little bit earlier in the first half of the show. And also it's going to have economics priority of China in the region. And obviously there is a military aspect to it, but I will come to the military dimension a little bit later in a separate point because that's very important. So talking about politics or economy or anything else you might think of in this line, at the end, these involvement going to play huge role in local politics. So how do you imagine the end game from Central Asian perspective?
Well, this is an interesting question because, on the one hand, certainly the people of Central Asia, especially those countries that border China, are increasingly wary about the Chinese presence, not just financial, where a lot of people have raised a red flag and said we're getting way too much in debt to this one country and it's bad. But, the Chinese deals in Central Asia, as they are everywhere, always involve Chinese labor, as Subrin pointed out, because they have their own employment that they have to think of too. So if there's a China National Petroleum Corporation is doing business in Kazakhstan, helping develop a site, that means you get a number of Chinese workers that come with that. It's the same with the gas fields in Turkmenistan. So of course there's that concern. Now, if I can kind of flip this a little bit, I would mention that the Chinese influence in Central Asia also means preserving the status quo in Central Asia as it is now. Therefore, for people like me who are in the West and hoping that we're going to see democratic reform and some kind of transition in the countries in Central Asia, the increasing Chinese presence in Central Asia works against that. Because the Chinese don't want those governments to change. They're doing business with them. For China, it would be a bad thing if the governments changed. They might want to renegotiate contracts. They might want to rescind contracts. All kinds of bad things can happen there. So in a way, China is getting what it wants out of there, but it's also committed to keeping the forms of government in place that are there right now, because that's the one they work with. People have made this, you know, with Turkmenistan, for instance, where we know that a lot of the money to pay back the Chinese loans is coming from gas that Turkmenistan is pumping to China. There's been suggestions that, you know, maybe if China was worried that maybe they would increase that and they would say, you know, 80% of your gas is paying off your debt. But Beijing does not want the Turkmen government to fail. That's a bad case scenario because then they have to deal with a new government. So they will always want to pay enough money for the gas so that they can keep that government afloat, or at least what they think will keep that government afloat. So the Chinese influence actually in the long run works against change in political change in Central Asia anyway.
So in other words, you are saying that extension of stagnation in the region. John, on the other part of the report, I also saw an interesting quote saying that trains are arriving full from China and leaving empty. I guess this is true wherever China does business, but what does it explain in terms of the local economy, China's influence in local economy in Central Asia?
So I think the rail story is pretty interesting, because one of the big questions economically is, are these routes going to be able to shift some trade inland? You know, and are they going to be able to compete with the existing maritime dominance of trade? Because over 90% of global trade right now is going by sea. China is talking up these new roads and rail links that it's building, mainly to carry goods from China to Europe, but also, you know, that same infrastructure could be used, you know, for extraction or for, you know, trade between China and Central Asia. And I think many of these routes, it's way too early to decide, I think, whether they're going to be viable or not. They're heavily subsidized, and even the very high-profile examples that you hear about, like the first train from Yiwu, China to London earlier this year, when you look into the details of it, yes, it went twice as fast as the cargo would have gone if it had gone by sea, but it's heavily subsidized. It had to change operators three or four times. The cargo is offloaded onto different trains because the track gauge changes. And so, you know, the more that you look into it, I think the more you start to wonder, is there actually demand for this? And are these going to be viable? And that kind of gets to your question about cargo is going out full and then it's coming back empty. We certainly hear stories about that happening between China and the European Union as well. So anecdotally, about, you know, one third of the cargo coming back empty.
Interesting. No, that also raises a little bit question, Bruce, maybe you would like to jump in here, about the compatibility of the local production with the incoming Chinese products. So where does this put the local market and local production in the long run?
Well, I mean, to some extent, we've kind of seen a small example of this in the cross-border trade that's going on. You know, I've been out in Kyrgyzstan and Kazakhstan, even parts of Tajikistan in the last few years. And Chinese merchants have come across and started to integrate into the local bazaars in these places. Mm-hmm. And they bring goods which are subsidized by the Chinese government and possibly of slightly better quality, but certainly comparable to what other local merchants are selling in Central Asia. And they end up outselling the local merchants, because they have goods which are equivalent or possibly better that they can sell at lower prices, and they push out the local merchants from the market. So this is a problem. It's really been one of the flashpoints in Central Asia, and I know from speaking with locals out there that this is one of the things that they really resent about the Chinese coming in there. So you know, will Central Asia be a dumping ground for Chinese goods? You know, the things that they need to sell, but they already have plenty of in their own country. That's a real possibility. It runs the risk of undercutting local markets in Central Asia, you know, because we know that what China is really interested in is the big resource materials. Mm-hmm. They're not going to buy Central Asian fruit, you know, or vegetables, or certainly not very much, mm-hmm. you know. And so what do they send across to to into Central Asia, well, you know, solar panels, things like that, that are not so easy to get and at relatively low price, and they end up running local businesses out of business.
Now, other very important aspect from my point of view, Sibron, talking about the security arrangement of this project. So what are the thinking in China about this, especially talking about Central Asia?
What exactly do you mean by the security?
I mean, if investments were to be made like exceeding trillions of dollars, there has to be a security arrangement for that. So yes. What China is going to do about this?
Well, there's various forms by which you can protect your local assets. Now, if you look at, for example, how the Obor project has been rolled out, you see various forms of security cooperation. The preferred way of conduct is working with local forces. So by, for example, channeling money into the local armed forces, training with local military, all these kinds of things, to make sure that they are actually up to the task of providing security for whatever it is that you're doing locally. Now, on top of this, China has been increasingly working together with private security contractors, and they increasingly use Chinese companies to do this. So now we all know the stories about the black waters of this world. China actually increasingly is building up an industry where it provides these services itself and also for hire for other companies worldwide. And they do this actually at a fraction of the cost of what, you know, the most of the North American companies are providing. So these are some of the things. Then, of course, it goes beyond this sometimes, but this we've only seen one case so far where, for example, recently, of course, the Chinese are said that they're going to be building this military base in Djibouti in Africa. Now, that, of course, you know, going all the way to creating expeditionary forces, et cetera, that's quite far away from what they're doing in Central Asia. And Central Asia is much more support to local forces financially, training-wise, et cetera, but also using private security contractors to make sure the facilities where Chinese companies are active are protected. Because in Beijing, they remember very well how the things went wrong in Libya and how they had to intervene to get their people out. And that's something that they wish to avoid next time around, whenever there's a crisis that might hit.
Bruce, what is your thinking on this? Like working with local security forces, how that's going to play out? Like they are incredibly corrupt, and how China is going to work with them, and how effective they will be?
Well, in the Central Asian case, and probably even further afield, of course, regime preservation is one of the key elements of really all the Central Asian governments, maybe Kyrgyzstan to a lesser extent, but the other ones are. So I think if you pitch it like that to them, and if I were to go to one of the, you know, to the Turkmen leader or something like that, I would say, you know, you have a potential security problem and you should really accept our help on this one, you know, and if you explained and, you know, and some of the scenarios that could overthrow their government or create instability in the country, I think you would have a very willing audience in a room of officials from any of these countries for doing that. You know, there's another element that comes into play in Central Asia that might not in some of the other parts of the world where Obor is supposed to be going. And that, of course, is that, you know, the Central Asian countries are all predominantly Muslim countries. Mm-hmm. And China's been very, very careful about not having its troops seen or heard from as much as possible in any of the countries where they are. I don't, you know, I've been making this argument for a while, but I don't think China considers it to be in its interest to have to put its own people, even as security forces, into a Muslim country, because if they, for some reason, they are involved in hostilities and they would kill somebody in the local population or something like that. This is one of the things that these extremist groups, non-state actors, look for to make this sound like, you know, it's a campaign against Islam. It has, you know, it's not about economics. It's not about helping a neighbor. It's not about anything like that. They're going after Muslims in the world. And of course, Russia and the United States are taking the hit for exactly that. Even though if you listen to Washington and Moscow, their goals in these other places are very different. But on the ground, among, again, these stateless groups, this is the kind of in that they're looking for to say, you know, that, you know, the Chinese are part of the same thing as Moscow and part of the same thing as Washington. And of course, once you have your far ranging ventures around the world, then you have a number of soft targets and it just multiplies. You have to guard different places all the time. And there's, you know, you need to create bigger security forces better armed and things like that. So I think they're kind of happy with the way things are in Central Asia, where they just kind of hype the threat a little bit with the Central Asian government, send them some weapons, maybe have a bunch of conferences and meetings about how they can increase the security, boost their strength on the ground, guard their borders, things like that, and let the Central Asians handle it themselves and repress their own people rather than the Chinese having an open hand in that.
Okay, so unfortunately we have to conclude the discussion before to do that, John. So,
Can I add just one thing on the security?
Sure. Yeah.
So I think the China-Pakistan economic corridor is sort of an interesting example, because on the Pakistani side, you do have an absence of security, and you've had over 50 workers killed working on CPEC projects. Mm-hmm. On the Chinese side,
exactly.
You have an overabundance of security, and it's very difficult to imagine on the Chinese part of CPEC in Western China, where the police presence is very heavy, and every large building is a security sector building. It's very difficult to imagine that being conducive to the flow of goods or people or business. And so, I think it's to me a reminder that there's a balance to be struck here.
Okay. So, concluding the discussion. So, we spoke about the political influence that is coming with this project to Central Asia, economic domination, and potentially a security dimension, and all these things. So, can Central Asian countries afford this level of domination, Bruce?
Well, I suppose the easy answer is they don't have a whole lot of choice at the moment. You know, if there comes a day where they diversify a lot more their economies, then that's possible. You know, that said, Obor brings another promise to them that if there's enough routes that go through Central Asia, then they get something as transit countries too. They can collect some fees, so that would be a benefit for them too. It might help to pay off some of the massive loans that they've taken from the Chinese already in the long run. But yeah, I mean, certainly they're going to have to diversify their economies and get off raw materials, which has been the curse of these countries for a long time. They're fortunately located, and historically they're fortunate too, because they do have that tie to Russia. So I don't think the Chinese would ever be able to so dominate Central Asia that they would forget about Russia. Russia wouldn't let them do that. So they're probably okay for now. But like I said, there's a lot of things that the Chinese can do to pressure them. There's still issues of where the borders are with China, and who knows where that could go if the Chinese really wanted to press, multi-billion dollar debts and say, with the old Chinese border is to this mountain range, not where it is now, and we want this land. There's a lot of things that could happen.
Okay, so Sibron, can Russia afford this level of Chinese domination in its traditional backyard?
Well, there the answer is somewhat similar, in the sense that at the moment, particularly economically speaking, Russia doesn't have a lot of choice, which is perfectly illustrated by how Russia has been trying to shape its energy relationship with Russia already for 20 years. If Russia would be dictating the terms to China, then surely natural gas would have been flowing to the Chinese already a long time ago, and it actually hasn't. So the money is coming from China. It's not coming from Russia. Most of these countries in Central Asia know this. They're disenfranchised about the Eurasian Economic Union, which essentially is a union to keep countries in, rather than to create some kind of trade bloc that can actually, punch above its weight internationally. That's not what it's designed for. So right now, Russia is pretty much forced to let the Chinese do what they are doing in Central Asia, at least in an economic point of view. But there is a kind of, I would say, tacit understanding that the Chinese also know that when it comes to real, say, the hardcore security provision, these countries are more likely to listen to what Moscow has to say than what China says. Also because the Chinese, as Bruce pointed out rightfully so, they don't want to become too involved up to the point that they may create adverse security conditions for themselves.
Okay. So, John, I understand from Bruce and Sibron that Russia or Central Asia, they stand no chance but to close their eyes to what China is doing these days in their country. So what choice does the United States have against what China is doing these days? Or does it care at all?
I think we're at an interesting moment with this set of issues and Washington policymakers. I mean, they obviously have quite a bit that they're concentrated on related to this. But I think that one of the challenges is that this is an economic issue which is going to take potentially decades to unfold. I mean, that's how the Chinese are talking about this initiative. You know, a lot could change between now and then, but it's a slow shift. It's not the type of crisis that rises to the top of a policymaker's desk. And so I think we're at this moment where a lot of policymakers in Washington are basically becoming aware of this set of issues. And have not yet decided on what their response will be. I think there's probably, you know, highly unlikely the U.S. would put together some sort of Marshall Plan for the region. I think U.S. spending on infrastructure is probably going to happen domestically first. But I think that there's plenty of other options that the U.S. has, including its role with the multilateral development banks, and also through partnering with, you know, other powers in the region. So Japan is, you know, quite involved in infrastructure in Asia. India is increasingly involved, although mainly concentrated on its domestic needs. So I think there's an opportunity to sort of shape standards and advocate for more transparency with some of these projects. And then the U.S. can do that through multilateral institutions and, you know, working with partners like the EU, India, Japan, and others.
Okay. Thank you very much for your insight, Jonathan Hellman, the Senior Fellow and Director of the Reconnecting Asia Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And big thanks goes to C. Brondi Young, the author of the report we just discussed, and Bruce Panier, the editor of Kishlok Owozi, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia blog, for your time in thoughts, gentlemen.
Thank you.
This is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the Majlis, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty Central Asia podcast. Until next week, bye-bye.